The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
In Lebanon, just keeping the lights on has become a challenge, so power generators are being fired up by independent operators. Now they're overcharging customers and fighting turf wars.
Some people call us some mobsters because they don't know what we are. We are people, normal people.
This man says they're just filling a void left by the Lebanese government. And a new generation of investors in Indonesia are buying up Bitcoin.
They don't want to work on the old school office or something like that. They want the freedom. Then they try to find a way to make their fortune.
But religious authorities have some problems with that. Also today, Sudan's prime minister has been reinstated, an update on Qatar's World Cup planning, and Justin Bieber in Saudi Arabia, some say not so yummy. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. We start today in Lebanon, where a series of crises have devastated the lives of people there. The economy is in freefall. There are severe fuel shortages, and public services like the state electric utility are almost non-existent. The World's Shirin Jafari has spent the last week reporting in Beirut. She joins me on the line now. People in Lebanon, Shirin, have been through tough times before, really tough times, right?
Of course, the modern history of this country, Marco, includes French colonial rule, Israeli occupation, and 15 years of civil war. But the last couple of years have been devastating. Lebanon saw massive protests in 2019 calling for the resignation of the government. That did happen last August, but only after a huge explosion at the Beirut port leveled parts of the city and killed at least 200 people. A lot of people were also injured. At this point, Marco, Lebanon is in financial collapse. Its currency has lost 90% of its value in the last 2 years. The pandemic has made everything even worse. And, you know, it's ordinary people who are really feeling the brunt of all this.
So you'll be bringing us stories from Lebanon this week and next. Where are you starting today?
I have been talking with people here in Beirut about something pretty basic and something that we sometimes take for granted in the U.S., and that's the electricity situation. Right now, Lebanon's state electricity provider supplies power to the public for about 2 or 3 hours a day. For the rest of the day, people have to rely on private generators for power. And businesses have sprung up in response, and they operate without any regulation.
All right, let's take a listen.
It's around 6 p.m. and Diala Yunus's family is gathered in one room. She and her husband have 4 kids between the ages of 1 and 11. For the past year, this has become their ritual. After sunset, they all huddle in one room under a single lamp. Diala says they do get power from the public utility, but only for an hour or two per day. She's resorted to sweeping the floors instead of vacuuming. She does the laundry by hand instead of turning on the washing machine. Just to keep that single lamp, plus the fridge running throughout the day, Diala's family now pays for power through a generator subscription. We have to put on a happy face for the kids, she says. But we cry when we're alone. Power outages have long been a part of life in Lebanon, but things have been getting worse.
The electricity sector has been one of the fastest sectors, let's say, to reflect the economic crisis the country has been living in.
Mark Ayoub is a researcher at the American University of Beirut. He says besides the economic crisis, Lebanon is also facing a severe fuel shortage.
So the public electricity utility doesn't have any more money to buy fuel or to procure fuel for our aging and old and inefficient power plants.
Aging power plants, fuel shortages, and a currency that's becoming more and more useless all spell disaster for families like Diala's. Businesses, especially smaller ones, are hurting too.
We have the lavender cake, We have the pavé. It's gluten-free and sugar-free.
At the Gustav ice cream store, employee Rana Idris lists the types of cakes they make. She says the store was forced to cut down its products because it has no way to keep them fresh. She points to a fridge that sits unplugged. We're living month to month, Idris says. We don't know how we can survive like this. The power cuts couldn't have come at a worse time for the ice cream store. The business was already losing profit because of the economic downturn. Idris says few people can afford luxuries like cake and ice cream. Then she switches to English.
I am working here. I cannot buy from here anymore. It's too expensive for me because I get my salary in Lebanese lira. That's why.
There is one type of cake, though, that has become more popular, Idris says. Divorce cakes.
Now it's something in.
In the absence of state electricity, many people in Lebanon have to depend on privately owned generators. These were popular during the Civil War in the 1970s. They faded away after peace took hold in the 1990s. Nowadays, every neighborhood relies on generators.
So this is where the generators are, I guess.
Do you want to watch a horror movie?
Watch a horror movie?
Come and walk with me.
45-year-old Michael owns and operates two generators in one of the neighborhoods in Beirut. He's tall and speaks with a New Zealand accent from the 10 years he lived in the country. He didn't want to give me his last name because he says the government puts pressure on operators who speak to the media. He walks me inside an abandoned high-rise. It's pitch black, so we turn on the lights on our cell phones. We walk two floors down.
This is the generator running.
It's a huge metal box with cables and switches inside. Michael has labeled each switch with the name of the street that it powers.
This is for next to the parking.
Before the recent crisis, Michael says he used to run the generators only for a few hours a day, and only for those businesses that couldn't withstand short interruptions. Now, he says, he runs them almost all day, except for a few hours needed to cool them down and to maintain them. There are hundreds of people like Michael who run generators all over Lebanon, says Mark Ayoub, the researcher at the American University of Beirut. Some businesses are smaller than the others, but none are regulated by the state.
They have their own networks, they have their own billing system, subscribers, and you see, people cannot but pay.
Recently, as demands for generators went up, the Lebanese media started criticizing generator suppliers, Michael says. They accused them of operating like the mafia, overcharging customers, and claiming their own turf. Michael denies these accusations.
Some people call us mobsters because they don't know what we are. We are people, normal people.
He says he's simply filling a gap left by the Lebanese government.
We did not cause the problem of the electricity. We are the solution of their mistake.
Michael says he's been losing money. He buys diesel to run the generators in US dollars, but he gets paid in Lebanese lira, which is devalued. Plus, he says, if it wasn't for him, businesses like the dentist in his neighborhood would have to shut down entirely. Back at Diala Yunus's home, she shows me her generator bills. They're six times what they were just a year ago. Diala used to be a teacher, but she lost her job at the start of the pandemic. So now her family relies on her husband's income. He delivers medical supplies to hospitals. Diala says she's had to ask for help from her family to pay the generator bills. She's been trying to figure out ways to bring down the costs. Like, she's learned a lot about candles, and that the ones made with beeswax last longer. Given how her generator bills have gone up, she says she'll be relying on candles even more. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Beirut, Lebanon.
Shirin's striking photos from Beirut will give you a good sense of what happens when the city falls into darkness. Take a look on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. Europe is battling yet another wave of COVID-19. New restrictions and threats of mandatory vaccinations have sparked huge street protests in the last few days. Belgian police used tear gas to disperse protesters in Brussels yesterday when tens of thousands rallied to oppose new COVID prevention measures. In the Netherlands, almost 150 people were arrested over the weekend after protests there. And in Austria today, a full-on lockdown has kicked in. But it's not dire everywhere in Europe. For more, our Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us from London. I mean, the level of public frustration really seems to be pretty clear in some of these cities, Orla, but is it just a minority, or have attitudes really suddenly turned against governments and their COVID restrictions?
Well, at the moment, it's still a minority that are out on the streets protesting, certainly in terms of the violent protests that we saw in the last few days in Brussels and in some of the Dutch cities. It is still a small number of people who are involved. And actually, there were protests earlier this year in some of these very same cities as well. In Rotterdam, for example, in the Netherlands, police clashed with anti-lockdown protesters last January. But it's also true to say that what we saw this weekend appears to be among the biggest anti-lockdown protests that we've seen in Europe since the pandemic began, and that frustration is really running high with some of the new restrictions coming in again. In fact, the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte said today that he accepted there's a lot of tension and a lot of frustration out there at the moment, and that people had the right to go to the street and protest about it. But he wasn't so kind, Marco, about those involved in the clashes with police.
What I nooit zal accepteren is dat idioten puur geweld gebruiken.
And he said, what I would never accept is that idiots use pure force against the people who are trying to keep this country safe. I should say, though, aside from Austria, the lockdowns we're seeing so far in Europe, they're still not as strict as what we would have seen last year or even earlier this year. You know, the measures are being introduced much more gradually than before. And even in the Netherlands, where there were so many protests over the last 3 days, shops and restaurants can actually still stay open until 8 p.m. every day. So it's a lockdown light there, as they call it.
So you mentioned Austria, Orla. They're planning to make vaccinations compulsory as of next February. What's the likelihood of other EU countries following suit?
Yeah, it's hard to tell at the moment. Austria does seem to have opened a can of worms. If you had asked me this question 6 months ago, I would probably have said no way would most EU countries even consider it. But in the last few days, we're seeing senior politicians in a number of EU countries talking about it. In Belgium, the health minister said he had been traditionally very much against compulsory vaccination. He said he had changed his mind. And then in the last 24 hours, the German health minister, Jens Spahn, used some pretty strong words trying to urge Germans to get vaccinated.
Wahrscheinlich wird am Ende dieses Winters so ziemlich jeder in Deutschland.
And what he said was Germans will be vaccinated, cured, or dead by the end of this winter.
Wow, that's a really stark presentation of the choices. We should note that not all of Europe is faring badly. There are some countries that really struggled with the first wave of the pandemic, like Spain. Right now, they actually seem to be doing okay. What can you tell us there?
That's true. And Portugal and Malta as well. In a sense, those countries, Spain and Portugal in particular, are sort of the poster child in Europe for getting the vaccine, because in Portugal, the rate is 88% of the country is double jabbed. In Spain, it's around 80%. Mm. And they have really low infection rates. And then one other important factor is that in Spain and Portugal, again, they have the highest rate of children under 18 who are vaccinated. And this no doubt has helped since the schools opened in autumn.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. So last year, a lot of Europe went into lockdown just before Christmas or a couple of days after Christmas. What's the likelihood of that happening again?
It's not looking good, is it? Germany has already said they are considering another full lockdown. Angela Merkel this afternoon apparently was talking to her party leaders, saying that Germany wasn't being tough enough and they needed to take stronger action. We're seeing some other EU countries following Austria's initial lead. If you remember last week, Austria introduced this lockdown for unvaccinated people. Well, today, the Czech Republic and Slovakia have done the same thing. Mm. Here in the UK, we had the health minister in the last 24 hours saying he hoped people could look forward to a Christmas together. But Marco, this time last year, Boris Johnson made a promise that he would not cancel Christmas. And a few weeks later, he pretty much did exactly that.
Mm. Well, I guess right now all bets are off. The World's Orla Barry in London, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Cryptocurrency. You may have formed your own opinions by now about whether it's the future of finance or just a passing fad, but have you pondered the religious considerations of crypto? Indonesia has. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We've been following the events in Sudan for some weeks now. A fragile power-sharing agreement between the military and civilian leaders fell apart after a coup last month. Yesterday, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok was reinstated after signing a deal with military leaders who orchestrated that coup. International and regional partners, including the U.S., are supporting this development, but as the world's Halima Gikande reports, this is far from the end of Sudan's problems.
Sudan's Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok has been absent from public eye for weeks, ever since he was detained by the military last month and then released on house arrest. But yesterday, he appeared side by side with the same man who orchestrated the recent coup, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who heads the Sovereign Council charged with transitioning the country towards democratic elections. I know our youth are capable of sacrificing, said Hamdok yesterday, but let's put an end to the bloodbath. Activists say more than 40 people have been killed in recent weeks by security forces amid nationwide protests against the military, including yesterday when this deal was signed. Activists say a 16-year-old boy was fatally shot in the head. Hamdok said in the conference that Sudanese blood is precious. He said he signed the deal to end the violence. Hamdok said the deal will put Sudan's transition to democracy back on track. It returns Sudan to the constitutional agreement signed between the military and civilian leaders in 2019, which is supposed to pave the way for democratic elections. General al-Burhan also spoke yesterday. Al-Burhan said the deal will create a real foundation for Sudan's transition, but he did not acknowledge the military's actions as a coup. The military has continued to deny this. Khalid Khayr is with Insight Strategy Partners, a think tank in Khartoum. She says yesterday's deal has put Sudan back to square one.
The military seems to have gotten a leg up over the civilians in that it has been able to craft a new agreement where it still maintains a lot of power and really hasn't had to give much up.
She added that's a problem because the military, with this recent coup, has proved itself an unreliable partner. Now Prime Minister Hamdok is facing his own criticisms.
This was an agreement that was unilaterally agreed and unilaterally brokered by the Prime Minister without the consultation of any civil society group, whether that's political parties or initiatives, organizations, or the street itself.
Yesterday, protests on the streets of Khartoum began chanting against Prime Minister Hamdok. Many have called him a traitor. Activists reject any continued partnership with the military. Many of Hamdok's own ministers are also against the move, including Sudan's foreign minister, Miriam El-Sadek El-Mahdi. She spoke today at a conference held by the Atlantic Council think tank in Washington.
So yesterday, we together stated a position that we are against what we saw in the TV because it is supportive of the coup.
Al-Mahdi said she and a number of ministers submitted letters of resignation to Prime Minister Hamdok yesterday. Meanwhile, protests on the streets are expected to continue. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
You can follow more of Halima's reporting about the power struggle in Sudan at theworld.org. Indonesia is big time into Bitcoin. Indonesia is also the world's largest Muslim-majority country, and while most people don't really see a link between religion and cryptocurrencies, Indonesia's religious authorities do. The country's top Islamic council has just ruled that cryptocurrency is haram, meaning it goes against the teachings of Islam. But what will that mean to the many Indonesian fans of Bitcoin? The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
The world's biggest economies are all facing the same dilemma. How to deal with cryptocurrency. China says ban it. The United States says regulate and tax it. India can't make up its mind. And then there's Indonesia, the world's fourth largest country, where officials are generally more positive about cryptocurrency.
The fact that our government focuses not on being a regulator, but on being an accelerator, I think it's already a good thing for the industry.
Asi Karengsi is the chairwoman of the Indonesian Blockchain Association. And get this. She says there are almost twice as many Indonesians invested in cryptocurrencies as the stock market. Half of all Indonesians are millennials or Gen Z, and to them, stocks may sound very 1980s, bringing slow profits. but they all know Bitcoin has shot up more than 600% in the last 2 years. They've seen online ads showing them how to buy it with their phones.
Dengan Rp10.000, kamu udah bisa investasi aset kripto untuk raih keuntungan yang wah.
That's an ad for Indodax, an Indonesian cryptocurrency exchange. You can get started with pocket money. Imagine you're a young Indonesian, you only have 50,000 rupiah to play around with, which is like $3.50. Asikaringsi says, no problem.
Crypto is a super cheap investment for youngsters. You can start with 10 to 50,000 rupiahs and get revenue. So easy money, if I may say.
But easy money. That's the sort of phrase that doesn't sit well with religious authorities. Indonesia has government-backed Islamic scholars. It's called the Ulema Council. And their latest fatwa, or religious ruling, is no trading cryptocurrency. They say it promotes gambling, uncertainty, and harm. I turned to a professor named Andri Alamsyah, a technology expert at Indonesia's Telkom University, and I asked him, will this get Indonesian crypto fans, most of whom are Muslim, thinking differently?
For young people, I don't think there's a big difference. The one that's already dive into the crypto space, they just continue to do it.
He says telling young people to give up Bitcoin is asking a lot, especially the college-educated Gen Z crowd, which sees crypto investing as maybe their only escape from toiling in a cubicle somewhere, making $1,000 a month.
They don't want to work on the old school office. They want the freedom. Then they try to find a way to make their fortune.
Professor Alamsyah thinks the fatwa may scare off older conservative Indonesians, but young people will probably just roll their eyes. After all, this Islamic council has also issued fatwas against Valentine's Day, Pokemon Go, Muslims saying Merry Christmas, and currently in the docket, watching Netflix. And here's the thing. The fatwa is a moral ruling, not a legal one. And the Ulema Council even said it is still open to being convinced that cryptocurrency could benefit society if it's treated like a commodity, like gold, oil, even frozen peas, and not a way to get rich quick. Now, if that distinction sounds fuzzy, welcome to the world of crypto, where the rules are messy, swinging back and forth as wildly as the prices. To the youth of Indonesia, Professor Alamsyah has some advice.
Yes. This is a gray area right now. So yeah, enjoy while it lasts.
A gray area, both legally and religiously. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. Villages across India's Punjab region were drawn into World War I, but there was no record of the men's service. Now a military database from the time has just gone online.
20 people is a lot of people to be serving in the Indian Army, going off to fight in Mesopotamia.
One village's sacrifice and what the descendant of a soldier from there discovered. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Chile held its presidential primary yesterday with the two winners on near opposite ends of the political spectrum, meaning a candidate on the far right will square off against someone on the far left. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia has more.
The candidate who came in first in this weekend's voting is a lawyer and congressman from the capital of Santiago.
Muy buenas noches, Santiago. Muy buenas noches, Chile entero. ¡Viva Chile!
55-year-old José Antonio Cast at a rally last night wore a navy blazer with a pin of the far-right party he founded.
La única candidatura presidencial que va a recuperar la paz.
Cast told his supporters that he is the only candidate who will bring back peace to Chile. He thanked them, and then he attacked his opponent and second-place winner.
Gabriel Boric y el Partido Comunista.
Gabriel Boric and the Communist Party want to pardon vandals destroying Chilean streets, Cast says. Boric is a former student protest leader, and at age 35, he would become Chile's youngest president in recent memory.
Amigas y amigos, compañeros, compañeras.
Boric wore a face mask as he greeted supporters last night in his hometown in southern Chile.
Yo no vengo acá a ocupar esta tribuna para hablar en contra del otro candidato.
I didn't come here to speak about the other candidate, Boric said.
Nuestra cruzada en todo Chile, en todos sus rincones, es la cruzada de que la esperanza le gana el miedo.
Our crusade in every corner of Chile is for hope to defeat fear, Boric said. Boric and Kast represent fairly new political parties, and that reflects voters' dissatisfaction with the moderate establishment. Claudia Heiss heads the political science department at the Universidad de Chile.
José Antonio Kast is an extreme right populist, very much like Donald Trump or perhaps like Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil.
Kast rose to popularity on waves of anti-migrant sentiment as tens of thousands have arrived from Haiti, Venezuela, and other countries. He's also promising a heavy hand against indigenous uprisings in southern Chile. Heiss says that Kast's supporters and most voters care about pandemic-fueled economic uncertainty. But Boric's supporters lean left.
People who voted for Boric see as more threatening to their security and to their stability the lack of social services, the lack of intervention of the state in providing health, education, pensions.
Support for Boric and Kast is in part a reaction to recent anti-government protests. In a way, it's also a legacy of the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet, which ended more than 30 years ago. Kast has boasted that if Pinochet were still alive, he would vote for him. Marianne González Lesso teaches legal history at the Universidad de Chile.
There has always been a good part of the electorate that has always been convinced that actually the dictatorship was necessary, that human rights violations were actually acceptable.
At the same time, González Lesso explains, Chile has also had strong leftist parties.
So there is actually still a strong left-wing and pro-communist popular base of support, because the Communist Party has always been a party that has been able to construct sort of social solidarity networks in low-income communities.
Also in this past weekend's midterm elections, voters cast ballots for Chile's Congress, and now it's pretty much evenly divided between liberals and conservatives. So whoever is elected president on December 19th will find continued opposition. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Staying briefly in South America, Venezuela is also counting ballots in local elections held there yesterday. More than 130 international monitors, mostly from Europe, were in place to keep tabs on the vote. Their presence was meant to build confidence in Venezuela's electoral system, but turnout was still low. This was the first time in 4 years that major opposition parties put candidates on the ballot. Opponents of President Nicolas Maduro have been unable to oust him from power, despite years of protests and international condemnation. Two missionaries who were being held hostage for ransom in Haiti have been released after more than a month. A Haitian gang had seized a group of 17 people from the U.S. and Canada, including several children. The U.S. State Department has so far had little to say about the release. U.S. officials have been closely watching the situation in Haiti since last summer, when Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated. Monique Kleska joins us. She's a retired United Nations development official based in Port-au-Prince. So this notorious gang called 400 Mawozo had seized these individuals, including an infant, and at least initially demanded $1 million per hostage. What do we know, Monique, about this partial release?
Well, we know very little about this partial release. What I can say is I think we're very happy that at least two people got their freedom, and I hope that the others will be released immediately.
FBI and State Department have officials in Haiti. What were their roles in negotiating with the gang for these two people and their release?
The Police Nationale d'Haïti, the PNH, has not shared any information. The U.S. Embassy has not shared any information. And the FBI has not shared any information, as we know. So we are really in the dark about this. But the point I want to make is people are being kidnapped all the time in Haiti. It is, you know, it's mind-boggling. It's heartbreaking. Whenever you think of, I'm going to step out of the house, you immediately wonder, will I be able to get back home? Because there are so many kidnappings. So this is very unfortunate that these were Americans, but French have been kidnapped and Haitians are being kidnapped every day, morning, noon, and night. So this is a nightmare.
I mean, that's a really good point for Haitians. This is a daily problem, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
How would you describe U.S. policy in Haiti right now?
This crisis is so deep that if it's somebody else who finds a solution, we will go back to the crisis. It's time for us to just sit together and work out what our problems are. And what we ask for the U.S. really is to give us the space, to give us the time, and to give us solidarity so that we can feel comfortable and move forward with the solution that we have put forward. As you know, I'm part of this commission trying to find a Haitian solution to the crisis. And we worked very hard trying to get together different sectors of the population. And we have put an accord, which is called the Montana Accord, on the table that has a kind of roadmap in terms of services as well as a governance structure. So it is up to us Haitians to find a solution, and we have one on the table so we can come together.
Do you think the U.S. has a coherent foreign policy toward Haiti?
I don't think it did for a very long time, because I don't think anybody quite knew what the U.S. wanted. But I think there is a move now towards listening to Haitian voices. There is a move to let us step back to do this, even though there is still some incoherency, because returning the migrants to Haiti, while you are saying that Haiti is gang infested, while you are saying that do not come to Haiti, because the U.S. has even asked Americans who are in Haiti to immediately leave the country. So there is some incoherence here.
You were referring, of course, to the Haitians earlier gathered at the U.S.-Mexico border a couple of months ago, many of whom were deported back to Haiti.
Exactly. There were about 8,000 who were deported back, and that to us was very incoherent, and I hope that that will stop.
Monique, some Democrats in Congress have called for the U.S. to make a course correction in Haiti. What would that look like?
Well, the course correction in Haiti looks like, one, leave us so we can chart our path forward. And this is what we have done with the Montana Accord. Second, talk to the different parties and encourage us to continue the dialogue that we are carrying. Third, remind the government that the U.S. and other international actors have put there, because it was a tweet that put them there, remind them that it is their responsibility to provide security and government services for Haitians, men and women and children. And fourth, then talk to the police that the U.S. has been supporting for a number of years. Remind them also that you must protect and serve the Haitian population.
Monique Leska is a former U.N. official speaking with us from Port-au-Prince. She works with a group called the Commission for a Haitian Solution to the Crisis. Monique, greatly appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
What you're hearing is typically played at military funerals on a bugle. It's called The Last Post, performed here on an Indian stringed instrument. Some 320,000 men from the Punjab region of India fought alongside British troops in World War I. But unlike their British comrades, records of these Indian soldiers were hidden away. They had been sitting in the basement of a museum in Lahore, Pakistan, collecting dust. But this month, scholars at the UK Punjab Heritage Association and the University of Greenwich began to post these records online. One of the first people to take a look joins us now. Manny Rao lives and works in San Jose in California. Manny, you searched the Punjab and World War I database. Who exactly were you looking for?
I was looking to find some mention of my great-grandfather, Dr. Hira Singh. He's a gentleman that I personally don't know too much about directly. And all I know is that we have an ancestral village, and there's a house there with the name on top of it saying Dr. Hira Singh and Sons, 1932. So he's sort of like the founder of the family. And so I'm like, okay, well, let's see if his name pops up in this digital registry.
And so when you were looking through the registry, what was it like finding his name?
It was pretty cool. I knew my ancestral village. So I searched for that little village in Punjab, and I was able to find it, double-clicked on the icon next to the village, and up popped something like 20 names of soldiers from that village who'd served in World War I.
Well, where did your great-grandfather serve in World War I?
So I had heard that he had gone on a troop ship to Iraq, and that was just one sentence of history that I've heard about him, about his military career.
Were you able to pin that down from the database?
Yeah, the database it noted that he served in Baghdad. And I'm like, okay, well, that ties in with what one of my aunts told me many years ago.
Wow. So your great-grandfather, Hira Singh, what did the Punjabi Soldiers website add to your knowledge about him?
Although the information was pretty limited, but it was the only primary source I had ever seen. So it had his name, his caste. He's a Jut, which means he's a farmer. And then his job in the military, he was a surgeon.
So these documents, they're all online. I mean, do you get a sense, though, of what they looked like?
Well, at first, the first thing that came up was a digitalized directory of names. But a little bit more research, it took me back to presumably what was found in the Lahore Museum, a handwritten muster roll with his name, Hira Singh, handwritten in English, and there are another 20, 30 names on that one page. I was surprised that so many people from my small little village out in rural Punjab, you know, a small, insignificant village, 20 people is a lot of people to be serving in the Indian Army and having fought, going off to fight in Mesopotamia. Of course, I only heard about my family member, but I was surprised that there were so many other families whose sons had served in the Indian Army and served in World War I.
What did your great-grandfather do after World War I? Do you know that part of the story?
Yeah. So he served his whole life in the military. That was his career. And I just know what he did towards the last years of his life. He was the administrator at the military hospital in Bombay, now called Mumbai. So he retired as the hospital administrator. What my great-grandfather was really, for me, it was really impressive about him is this is in the 1920s. He insisted that all his sons get educated. At least he tried to get them all the way to be educated to a PhD level or a medical doctor level. So he had five sons, and my grandfather was his oldest son. He paid for him and his wife to go to the UK in the 1930s, so he could get his PhD.
Given that these records that led to your knowing of your great-grandfather's role in World War I, given that they were in a basement in Pakistan gathering dust, I know the database just went live, but what is it doing to the understanding across the Indian diaspora of the role played by the country's soldiers in World War I?
It's surprising how few Indians of our generation are aware of what a big part the Indian Army played in World War I. I had some idea because I'm very interested in history, but across the Indian diaspora, you hear a lot of people saying that they're very proud of the martial tradition of Punjabi soldiers, and a lot of the Indian Army was recruited from the Punjab, the United Punjab. And then you also hear other people saying, oh, these people just served the British and they were used by the British. But I always respond back saying these people, they weren't used by the British. They used the British for their own advantage. They used the opportunities presented by going into the military, seeing the world. And that's why there's such a huge Indian / Punjabi diaspora all over the world.
Mani Rao was telling us about Hira Singh, his great-grandfather, whose name and service record, along with those of hundreds of thousands of other Punjabis, were retrieved from a basement in Lahore, Pakistan, and put online. Mani, thank you very much for telling us about the project and about your great-grandfather.
Well, it's my pleasure, Marco. Thank you for reaching out.
We're just under a year away from the World Cup of Soccer. Qatar is hosting for the first time, the first Arab nation to do so. It's major prestige, but the preparations have come with plenty of controversies. Chief among them, the impact on migrant workers who are doing the labor. With us now is Isabel Archer. She's the Gulf Program Manager at the Business and Human Rights Resource Center in London. Isabel, can you give us a snapshot of how reliant Qatar has been on migrant workers to prepare for the 2022 World Cup?
Well, migrant workers have been absolutely central all along to the preparation of this tournament, the building of the stadiums, the building of, you know, other associated infrastructure in the country. And they'll be certainly integral to the kind of experience that, you know, fans, football teams, everyone who's planning on visiting Doha during the tournament will have. So, you know, everyone will be flying into Hamad International Airport, built by migrant workers, served by migrant workers. They'll be taking public transport into the city or being driven by migrant workers. They'll be checking into hotels that have been built by migrant workers. Their entire experience will be down to these workers.
I know there'd been a lot of concern about migrant construction workers and their living conditions, even human rights concerns. Now we're hearing about the workers who are in hotels and will be staffing them when the spectators arrive. I know Qatar has added 26,000 rooms to accommodate incoming teams and fans and the media. What has that meant for the migrant workers involved?
Well, at this stage, preparations were still a year out. So actually what we're seeing at the moment is hotels still being finished, but we are expecting, you know, a huge recruitment boom to staff those hotels. You know, they're going to be operated by workers from South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Africa, doing, you know, all the jobs from kitchen workers, security guards, restaurant workers, to make sure everyone is having, you know, an excellent time. From our research, what we're seeing is that the brands themselves, and we're talking, you know, the biggest multinationals in the world, have not done enough and have not stepped up to be able to put in place safeguards, oversight mechanisms over these workers' working conditions, to be able to say that, you know, the environment, the working environment that they should expect to have to be faced with when they arrive in Doha is there.
And Isabel, when you say brands, what are the brands that you feel have a responsibility to address this?
Well, it's all brands. You know, many of the kind of brands that we've been speaking to and surveying are international. So many of them are headquartered in Europe, North America, Asia, but also local companies. And this, you know, the responsibility for these workers isn't sort of limited to a discrete group of companies, but all companies who employ workers in the country.
So hotel brands.
Yes, exactly.
I'm also hearing that some migrants have had their passports withheld. Isn't that illegal?
So yes, that is illegal. You know, I think many of the kinds of risks that we see not in line with the labor law. So these are experiences that workers are having. So actually what we've seen in the past couple of years in Qatar has been an improvement in the labor standards. But what we're not seeing is the kind of implementation of those standards.
What are the details of some of those poor working conditions?
So in terms of working conditions, delayed salaries is still something that's very prevalent. As I say, illegal deductions is also something that's been cited by workers. We did also have, you know, workers for our most recent research tell us that they were being paid less than other nationalities. In terms of living conditions, workers are still being housed in cramped accommodation, so sharing rooms with a lot of people. And I think that the key takeaway from our engagement with the industry has actually been that workers are still not able to leave employment and to change jobs. And this is especially alarming for us because this has been a key reform that Qatar has pushed.
Isabel, do you think there's still time for Qatar and these hotel chains to improve their record on migrant labor issues?
Well, I think there's definitely room for improvement for the hotels, certainly. We've made a number of recommendations to hotel brands that hotels could be putting in place to safeguard workers. So, for example, ensuring that workers have access to a joint committee. You know, unions are banned in Qatar. However, it is possible for companies and hotels to put in place committees that workers can join, management representatives can join, in lieu of another a sort of forum. And these are things which definitely can be being put in place in the next year, so that when kickoff happens, in just over a year now, workers will have access to those sort of avenues that they should have had access to all along, but which will seriously decrease the risk of their being exposed to labor rights abuse in the future.
Isabel Archer is the Gulf Program Manager at the Business and Human Rights Resource Center, telling us about how preparations for the upcoming World Cup in Qatar are impacting migrant workers. Isabel, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The Beeb is going to Saudi Arabia. Justin Bieber is headlining a concert in December in the city of Jeddah on the Red Sea. not far from Mecca. Landing a huge international pop star is a big get for the conservative kingdom. In recent years, Saudi Arabia has become less socially restrictive, embracing concerts, movies. Next month, a Formula One race. That's where Bieber is slated to perform. Political scientist Besma Momani at the University of Waterloo in Ontario says the Saudi government is trying to appease its young population.
They are often bored, quite literally find themselves with very little activities. And concerts and other new types of entertainment are really meant to appease young people and provide a new support base.
That would be support for Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his social reform schemes. But playing Saudi isn't like doing Vegas. Artists like Bieber give legitimacy to Saudi Arabia. The kingdom has also booked international stars like Mariah Carey and Nicki Minaj in recent years. Besma Momani says the concerts are partly an effort to whitewash the kingdom's human rights violations.
By appearing to be more Western and more open to the outside world.
Human Rights Watch is asking Bieber to pull out of the concert in Saudi Arabia. So is the widow of slain Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. 2 years ago, Nicki Minaj canceled her Saudi date, saying she wanted to show support for women's rights, gay rights, and freedom of expression. Mariah Carey brushed off the calls. The University of Waterloo's Besma Momani says while criticisms of Saudi Arabia are valid, it's equally valid to see a performance by Justin Bieber for what it is, an outlet to entertain Saudi youth.
They are indeed happy to see Western stars come to the kingdom. They feel finally that their country is listening to their needs. And so while we can very much criticize from the outside, I think we also need to be a bit more sensitive to the needs and aspirations of Saudi youth.
No reaction from Justin Bieber's people on the criticism of his planned visit to Saudi Arabia. He's been busy on a world tour promoting his new album. Its title, Justice. You know you can call me if you need someone. I'll pick up the pieces if you come undone. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
From PRX.